Welcome back to another episode of The Political Life. Today, we have a very special guest with us who has come to us through prior guests, I think through Marcus Mason and Nicole, if I'm correct. But we have Tasha Cole, and Tasha can tell me if that's correct. Tasha, in her current role, is the Chief Diversity Officer of the DCCC, and we are very excited to have Tasha on. We're going to hear about... She has had many interesting jobs besides her current work at the DCCC. She has worked on the Hill, done campaign work, I think primarily in Florida, and out of college, actually got her start in public television. So we're going to hear about all that. And Tasha, welcome to the show.
Happy to be here. I'm so excited. Thanks for having me.
Oh, we're so glad to have you. So what has it been like in your current role at the DCCC, given the year that we've had?
Unpredictable, but transformative. I have been fortunate throughout my career to be part of historic occasions. I worked in 2000 on the Gore Lieberman campaign. Didn't know that would be a historic assignment. I worked on the Democratic Convention in 2008 and again, and had a chance to work in 2016. So this is, to me, has just been historic that we would be at this place at this time. Didn't know there would be a pandemic, didn't know we would be in a quarantine, didn't know that we would have to campaign, our campaigns and our candidates would have to go virtual and not use the traditional get out the vote and voter contact of door to door and in-person campaigning. So it's been historic. It's been unpredictable. I regret that I didn't get to spend as much time with my colleagues in person as I would like, but we are all very virtually connected. And so it's been fun and interesting.
Well, if we follow all the polls, it seems as if you're going to have a good year. And have your candidates, have they adjusted to the campaigning remotely, or are they finding it difficult to do, or how is that working?
I think they've adjusted. I think at first, you know, for especially for candidates who've ever run before, they served in another capacity, either as a state legislator or county commissioner, city commissioner. I mean, there is an adjustment. This is a very face-to-face contact profession, and to have to switch to virtual was an adjustment, but they adapted. It was great. I think they found that they could reach more voters, more constituents, because they could be connected over Zoom or over phone virtually. And they had an opportunity to have some very meaningful conversations because there was not this hustle and bustle to have to coordinate driving from one location to another. So I think it presented some great opportunities to bring in young people and to bring in people who may have, you know, now they're working from home. They couldn't campaign or volunteer before because they had a day-to-day job that they had to commute to, and they no longer had to commute. So there are people who now could volunteer for these campaigns in their off hours and off times when they didn't have that opportunity before.
And in your current role, where do you spend most of your time? I know that you said that you work on vendor recruitment, equity and inclusion, staffing. It seems like you have quite the wide portfolio. Now, I'm sure it's different when you're right now, we're obviously a week before the election as we record this, but after the election, let's say, where will you spend most of your time working on?
Well, this is the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee has always had a diversity department, and obviously as part of its mission was to kind of expand the Democratic coalition to be more diverse. But this is the first time that they've had a chief diversity officer. It was actually a recommendation that I made during the interview process, just as a candidate, that it was something they should consider elevating the title so that it would be comparable to the title in other sectors. And I'm a part of the senior management team. So you're right. I've been working on vendor recruitment, working with all of the departments that work with vendors, but also staffing, helping with recruiting and identifying staff, and, you know, also presenting information and speakers and presentations to our staff that we would not normally have the opportunity to do, which helps them apply the values and principles to their work that they do with our campaigns and with our candidates throughout the country. So right now, my colleague, Carlos, I have a great colleague named Carlos Duran, who's been at the committee for a couple of cycles. He's my associate director, and we're actually getting ready, and we're planning the election night, the virtual election night, because like all things, this will be the first time that the staff will have to do an election watch, you know, online. Usually they would probably all gather together. But this time, once we wrap up all the work that we do on election day, we'll come together virtually. So we are planning that. And then after the election, I will work on getting ready for the next cycle, putting transition plans in place, and also probably putting together some professional development opportunities for the staff as they look at career options, either within the committee or all the opportunities that will exist once the election is over. Regardless of the outcome of the election, anytime a presidential year in Washington, D.C., there's a whole shift. People leave K Street, they go to K Street, you know, they come on and off the Hill, they leave the administration or into the administration. So there'll be many opportunities. And I think people will seriously, because they've been in quarantine, think about, do they want to stay in Washington, D.C.? Do they want to move out of the area or, you know, look for other opportunities? So I look forward to working with my colleagues on that and with them on that.
Now, I know, Tasha, you grew up in Florida and you mentioned the Gore-Lieberman campaign. Were you working in Florida on the Gore-Lieberman campaign?
I was. And for anyone who's listening and knows me, little known history, I actually am not a native Floridian. I went to school in at Florida A&M. That's how I got to Tallahassee, Florida. But my parents have been living in Illinois for almost 30 plus years. And we were born in Talladega, Alabama. So I have moved around quite a bit. But my formative adult years were spent in college at FAMU and then afterwards working in television. And yes, I am a survivor of the Gore-Lieberman 2000 election some 20 years ago this year.
Were you down there dealing with the hanging chads?
I did not have to deal with the hanging chads. I actually was based in our headquarters in Tallahassee, Florida, but I was working with a lot of our team members who were down in Palm Beach. And funny enough, I was scheduled to go to a wedding. I was going to drive to a wedding right after Election Day. And my colleagues, my boss at the time, Nick Baldick, said, nope, we can't afford to have you drive down and be out of the, you know, headquarters for that many days. So I ended up flying down for the wedding and having to come right back to Tallahassee. And the wedding was in Palm Beach. So I drove by the supervisor elections office, but I had to return back because there were a lot of us working out of headquarters with lawyers and field staff on this reimagined post-election opportunity and day and weeks and months. We had no idea. This was unprecedented. We didn't know. This is before social media, you know, before all the things that we're familiar with now did not exist at that time. We just knew it was election day and it would be over. And that was not to be the case that year in 2000.
Well, we may face a similar type of situation this year with the vote counting, obviously with the mail-in voting, and may take a few days, hopefully not longer.
I think it will. I mean, we should be prepared that because of the number of states who count ballots after the volume of people who are voting now in person and mail-in ballots, we need to be prepared that this will not be over on Tuesday. There are states like California who have been doing mail-in ballots for years, and there have been special elections even as recently as this year that it was not decided until a few weeks after the election day. And that's one state in one congressional district. So if you multiply that, we should be prepared. And I think that's okay. We need to count every vote. Democracy is important. I know that both sides are anxious for a decision, and those working on the campaign are anxious for a decision to happen. But I think we need to be prepared that this process will take, will go on beyond election night. There may be clear winners, there will be victories, but I think the totality of what the victories look like, we may not know until maybe a few weeks after election day.
And so out of college, you went to work in public television.
I did.
And you worked on a few documentaries. That sounds like exciting work.
Well, one of the documentaries I produced was on a slave ship called the Henrietta Marie that left Europe and Africa to bring slaves down to Jamaica. And the Jamaican slave trade was also a component of the documentary. It was different than the colonial American experience that many of us learned, even if it was briefly when we were in school. The slaves in Jamaica were cutting sugarcane under horrendous circumstances. Many of them died. They did not survive. But the slave ship, after it left the slaves, you know, to return back to Europe, sunk. And there were a group of divers and others who found the remains. They dedicated a memorial down there to it. So we covered that and also featured of the life of a slave. There were pewter, there were shackles and other remains that were found that were connected to the ship. And so all of that was profiled in the documentary.
And then you also, during that time, covered the Florida legislature. Is that what led you to have an interest in politics and ultimately make the jump to politics?
Yes, it was. I had an opportunity to cover the Florida legislative session, which happened 2 months every year. And every night we would cover the committee hearings, the floor proceedings, all of the activity that happened in the 2 months. It was exciting. It was very interesting. I was not familiar with it until I started covering that. I had an opportunity to make some relationships with the Florida Black Caucus and other members and other Democratic leaders down there. And I think ultimately that's what sparked my interest and led to the work that I did with the Florida Democratic Party.
Now, it seems like you had great success at public television with those documentaries that you worked on. Was it tough to leave?
It was tough to leave at first. When I started in journalism at Florida A&M, you were supposed to, you know, move from market to market, start off in a small market, and then eventually end up in the network news. And I had friends at the time and friends who had graduated before me who they were doing that work, but it was hard. And the salary was not, I mean, it's the salary at that time to be a reporter in a small station was $10,000 to $12,000 a year, maybe $15,000 a year. And so, you know, that was difficult to maintain any kind of lifestyle. You know, you might get a small apartment, but just the cost of living in many of these areas, even though it was small, was challenging. And so I think I wanted to find other ways that I could communicate and make contributions to telling stories and telling narratives through other platforms or through other vehicles. I started working with a child advocacy center and did some other consulting work before I eventually ended up at the State Democratic Party. But it was challenging to make that decision to transition. And at the time, I didn't know that I would never return back. I think I thought I would just take a pivot, take a detour and return back. I don't think I knew that I would not return back full time. I'm fortunate to have opportunities like this with podcasts. And now Zoom is actually like being on television. It has a lot of similarities. But it was a difficult decision. But I'm glad that it worked out in the end.
Yeah, it's strange how you don't realize at the time that it's a permanent fork in the road, and you think it's just temporary. I think we have all faced that. Well, that's very interesting to hear about that work. And then ultimately, you came to run a congressional campaign in Florida for Congressman Meek, correct?
Was that? And yes, then, Kendrick Meek.
Kendrick Meek, and then went on to work in his office on the Hill.
Yes. He and I started working together at the Florida Democratic Party when I was essentially a political director. Then it was called constituency outreach director, but he was a state senator. And we actually worked on what became legendary, a march on Tallahassee in response to Governor Bush, then Governor Bush, his attempt to end affirmative action in the state of Florida. And this is one of those issues that sparked anger in the Florida electorate, particularly Democrats in 2000, which led to the historic 2000 election results, because there was an overwhelming number of voters who came out against Jeb Bush and against his policy to end affirmative action. So that's really how Kendrick and Meek and I first got to know each other. We went on bus trips, several bus trips across the state of Florida, energizing and engaging voters on behalf of not just the Democratic Party, but on behalf of democracy and fairness and inclusion and diversity, even at that time in 2000. I went on to work with the Service Employees International Union as a state director. So I had a great career helping them organize workers and pass historic nursing home legislation. Then he asked me, did I want to come to Washington, D.C. after I worked on his congressional campaign? And that's what led me to Washington, D.C. to work as his communications director and set up his freshman office. His mother had served in Congress, so we were fortunate to have some of the staff on board, including a great chief of staff named John Shelby. He was my first chief of staff on Capitol Hill. He had been on the Hill for almost 30 years, so he was a great resource and a great leader for us, as for those of us who were new to Washington, D.C. and new to Capitol Hill and new to Congress. We were very fortunate to have him. Kendrick Meek was no stranger to Congress. He had been up there visiting his mother, had served in the Florida legislature. But it was a great time. It was snowing when we first got here. I'm from Chicago, so that was not unfamiliar to me. But for the rest of my Florida colleagues, they were not prepared that the day we got here off the auto train, we would find snow here in Washington, D.C. in December.
And how did you enjoy your time working on the Hill? Because you worked for him and then the person after him, correct?
Yes, I worked for Congresswoman Frederica Wilson, who followed him. Both of them had served in the Florida legislature, so I knew her from my days in Florida. It was exciting. I mean, we were there 8 years, four terms. He was considered a rising star, emerging star, was very close to the Democratic leadership. We were from Florida, so we were a battleground state. So there was an incredible amount of political interest in not only the state, but our district. Miami-Dade County is one of the most Democratic performing counties in the country. So there was a tremendous amount of interest in the work that was being done in Florida. A lot of the public policy issues that we see on the national stage are, you know, they originate in Florida. So it was exciting. I loved it. I encourage people, if they have the opportunity to work on the Hill, to spend time there. I had an opportunity to work under both a Democratic administration with President Obama, but to also work under George Bush in a Republican administration, and to see and be a part of how you have to work across the aisle to build bipartisan coalitions. And on behalf of the state, on behalf of your constituents, you have to reach across the aisle and work in your delegation and other state delegations. So it was a great training ground. You learn and meet so many people. I'm still close to many of the people that I met on Capitol Hill, Nicole Venable and Marcus Mason, and probably other guests that you've had on here. The time that we spent on Capitol Hill, we still refer back to that and all the contributions that were poured into us as a result of us being in this very fast-paced environment where no day is ever the same. You can wake up thinking you're going to work on a project and something is happening down in your district. And you have to, I mean, we had people who would come over from Haiti. You know, there might be people who have, you know, issues in their district or in their homes or in their neighborhoods that they need attention right then and right now. So you never knew what to expect. It was always unpredictable.
And How did you find working across the aisle? Is that just part of the job, unusual, difficult, or just not a big deal?
I think it has changed. At that time, it was not unusual to work across the aisle. It was expected. Some of Kendrick's best friends in the Florida legislature were Republicans. We worked very closely with Diaz Balart's office, Congresswoman Ross Layton. Both of them were South Florida Republicans. So you had to work across the aisle to, you know, find co-sponsors for your legislation, or you had to work across the aisle to deliver services to your constituents, many of whom, you know, party labels were not really relevant to their day-to-day reality. They wanted you to bring home resources to help their lives. And so you had to form these coalitions and these relationships. And it would also give you empathy and insight into not just your district or your state, but the country. And so you had an opportunity to work either on legislation. There were trips where we would travel together as bipartisan coalitions. And that was really when you got to learn and understand different perspectives. It didn't mean that you agreed all the time, but you at least had some understanding and insight into how they arrived at the decisions or why they were promoting policies and procedures and opportunities. You know, you had some insight into how they came to those decisions.
That's well said, Tasha. Well said. And so, and, you know, we kind of skimmed over, but you had a big job in running that union in Florida. That is being state director and figuring out your legislative priorities and getting people engaged. That is quite an important role that you had down there in Florida working in that role.
SEIU is, and at that time, was one of the fastest growing unions in the country and definitely in the state. And I was recruited, like many of my positions, I have been recruited into roles. People sought me out. We worked together. They identified that I may have resources or contacts or relationships that could be beneficial to their efforts to expand or transform the work that they were doing. So working with SEIU, I had an opportunity to work with nursing home workers. We predominantly represented nursing home workers and hospital professionals. And so I have a real empathy and understanding of what our essential workers that we're seeing right now, what they are facing and what they are going through. And we formed a coalition of members and outside groups to pass historic nursing home legislation in the state of Florida. We had lobby days. We brought members up to the state capitol to advocate and, you know, visit their representatives, visit their senators, and tell their stories about what they were facing at nursing home workers. The number of hours that they were working far exceeded the number of hours they should be working. And the ratio of nursing home workers to the patients and the elderly that they were taking care of. So we fought to increase the opportunities that these nursing home workers had. They are taking care of many of our loved ones, our parents at some point, and ourselves at some point. And so in a state like Florida, with the senior population that we had, this was an issue that was of utmost importance. And they really wanted, they recruited me from the Florida Democratic Party, particularly because of my experience working on political campaigns, but also working in institutions and in government institutions and political institutions, and how they could navigate and transform their profile beyond just being leaders. So that's why it was important for us to pass legislation. We held a gubernatorial debate with, at the time, Janet Reno was running for governor in the state of Florida. So we held a gubernatorial debate with all the Democratic candidates and had over 500 SEIU members who were in the audience and had SEIU members who asked questions to the candidates, and it was covered on many of the, you know, by the media in Florida. So it was a good time. It was a good time. It was a good experience. I was fortified by spending time with people who appreciated the work that me and my colleagues were doing. And they too wanted to put in the work, put in the time, and meet with their legislators and do what needed to be done to sort of transform the image that many people had of not only unions, but the constituents and the members that they represent.
And Tasha, tell us about, you spent 7 years or almost 8 years at the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation. Tell us about your work there.
Well, I was recruited and asked to come and work as the vice president of resource development for the foundation. I was responsible for managing our strategic partnerships and soliciting resources through donors, through corporations, through grants and foundation money on behalf of the foundation. The mission of the organization was to eliminate disparities in the Black community. It had four pillars, still has those four pillars of, you know, eliminating disparity, economic disparity, environmental disparity, education disparity, and health. And so I was responsible for managing a team that was responsible for raising money for almost a $12 to $13 million budget. We had CBCF has interns and fellows that come through the program. We have a scholarship program where we disperse scholarships to students in the CBC, the Congressional Black Caucus member districts. So during my time there, during the 7 years, I raised nearly $70 million on behalf of the organization. We produced the annual legislative conference, which happens every year. This year, of course, it had to be virtually, but usually 10,000 of our closest friends would converge on Washington, D.C. every September for a week of issue forums and receptions and celebrations in honor of the foundation, but also in honor of all the work that the Congressional Black Caucus does throughout the year. So it was, I loved the time there. I had an opportunity to travel internationally. I took a group of young, some of our young emerging leaders to Japan. And so that was an exciting opportunity to see that country, but to also see the country through the eyes of these young people from across the country, many of whom had never traveled abroad. So we stayed in a, you know, several places, very, you know, hostels and, you know, motel-like accommodations in Japan. Of course, many of these young people overpacked. So that was funny after we told them to only bring one bag, but they learned so much. But we also had some young people on there who had traveled and could speak Mandarin or could speak other languages. And so they had an opportunity to come together. So I had, it was very fulfilling. I'm still in touch with many people that work at the foundation and so many of the young interns and fellows who are so appreciative of the resources that they had. We offered a paid internship program. We offered housing so that they come to Washington, D.C. and intern on Capitol Hill. But not for those resources. They would not be able to come to Washington, D.C. As we all know, if you live in Washington, D.C., it is not cheap to live there. It is not cheap. You need coins. You need resources. And so they were very appreciative of that opportunity. And for me, it was very fulfilling to work on partnerships and to work with Fortune 500 companies, but to also work with advocacy groups on how we could provide resources and open doors and provide platforms for these young people to succeed. We also put on public policy forums. You know, there were plenty of opportunities around, not just Washington, D.C., but nationally. We traveled to cities doing economic summits to talk about the role of African-American business owners and entrepreneurs and what challenges and opportunities they faced. So that was very exciting. Got to meet the President of the United States and Michelle Obama and so many other dignitaries, and also just the everyday people who came to the conference. They would travel from all over the country just to come to our conference. So just to be able to interface with them and to see how excited they were to see government in action when they came to Washington, D.C. Was very exciting and was great. I loved every minute that I worked there, even if I didn't know it at the time.
What a great program. So when you look back on your career, what advice would you give to a young Tasha? What would you do differently? And what do you think you did right? You obviously did a lot right because you have had some incredible jobs you know, so clearly you've made some right choices and impressed people, because you wouldn't be given these opportunities if you didn't impress people. So if you're looking back, giving young Tasha some advice, what would you say, or to young people today?
I always tell young people today to go to grad school as early as possible in your career. I was in television. We were not encouraged to go to grad school in television. You were supposed to work in different markets and eventually end up, you know, in New York at one of the national networks, or end up at CNN. And so we were not discouraged, but we were not actively encouraged to go to grad school. So if I were to talk to a young Tasha or talk to any young leaders, I always encourage them to get as many degrees as you can while you are young. I know a lot of great people who have gone back to school through their later in their professional career, and they successfully graduate. But some of the stress that is put on them as a working professional and a working student is different. I know everyone financially can't always afford to go. So obviously there are so many scholarship programs that exist now that did not exist for returning students when I was coming along, but I encourage to take advantage of all of the education opportunities that you can, certificate programs. There's all kind of great online virtual programming now that you can take advantage of to constantly improve your skill set. And I always encourage young people to really think about their work-life balance. Where do you want to live? Are you someone that has to take care of your family? Will you have to support your family? Do you think you want to get married? Do you think you want to have children? So I encourage young people when I talk to them, which is often. I mean, I'm fortunate that and blessed to have the opportunity to talk to young people, which provides me the opportunity to reflect on my own choices and, you know, the choices that I still have going forward. But I always encourage them to think about their work-life balance. And, you know, especially now in this pandemic, we have more time on our hands than we probably imagined to think about this. But to think about where you thrive, you know, what kind of work environment do you thrive in? What kind of work culture do you want to be in? So those are some of the things I did not necessarily take into consideration when I was young. But I think that, to your point, I feel very blessed to have all these opportunities, but I really encourage them to be thoughtful about that if they can. Do you think you want to live near your family, or do you think you want to travel? Because that may dictate the kind of work you want to do, what kind of salary you want, how important are benefits to you. And I know it's a lot for young people, but I always hear back from so many of them that thank me and are appreciative that I took the time to have that conversation beyond just how to write your resume or a cover letter or give an elevator speech, but to really think about the personal fulfillment that they will need, because that makes them, a better worker. And how you show up at work, you know, has a lot to do with who you are. And so that you can survive and thrive, especially if you are in a very demanding career or very demanding industry. You have to be grounded. You have to have some sense of your own character and your own likes and dislikes and what kind of work culture you want that will make you be as successful as you want to be, regardless of what the industry or profession is.
That's great. Well, Tasha, this has been really wonderful to have you on. I guess we can end on a lighter note. You mentioned you were from Alabama. Auburn or Alabama for football?
That's a great question that I never answer. But I will say I probably lean more towards Alabama.
That's right. You don't have to answer it. Yeah.
Yeah. Don't tell my Auburn cousins that.
And you said, did you say your parents are now in Florida? Did you say that at the beginning?
Actually, my parents are in Schaumburg, Illinois.
We
moved around quite a lot when I was growing up. We lived in San Antonio, Texas, Danbury, Connecticut, and St. Louis. My parents, we are part of that last migration out of the South. And my dad had a great job opportunity with what was then called General Foods, which eventually became Kraft Foods. So the early 70s, we left Talladega, Alabama, and moved to San Antonio, Texas, and spent 5 years in San Antonio, Texas. We were obviously one of the few African-American families that lived there. So my dad would make a great podcast guest because he has very many stories about some of the challenges he faced as an African-American man in San Antonio, walking into grocery stores, because that was his job, was to sell General Foods products. And they would call back to his boss and say, don't send that in word back into the store. So that, you know, they grew up. My parents grew up in segregated South in Alabama, but those were some of our first experiences. And my dad had two job offers, one to be an air traffic controller or to work at General Foods. And General Foods had a company car, and he had a baby, me, that had a car seat that needed to go into a said car. So we left San Antonio, moved to St. Louis, moved to Danbury, Connecticut, and ended up outside of the suburbs of Chicago, Illinois, Schaumburg, which is near Naperville, where Congresswoman Lauren Underwood represents. So they love it there. They've been there 40 years. They don't even mind the snow. It snowed yesterday in Chicago and they didn't skip a beat.
I love the fact that you, when you mentioned where they live now, you slip in who their congressperson is. Clearly your work does not leave you. Tasha, do you have any siblings?
I do. I have a younger sister named Paula.
And where does Paula live?
She just moved to Columbus, Ohio to work with Nationwide. She's heading up a new business unit they have called, I think it's Pension Risk Transfer. I had to read the press release to make sure I understood what her new role and title is. But she is 8 years younger than me. She's married, has a niece who is my spirit animal, who is 4 years old. And she also has an older daughter named Emma, who is a freshman in high school. And so she acts like most 14 and 15 year olds at this time. But yes, it's fun. I loved having a sibling. At first, it was just me. And then my sister came along. And funny story, I wanted to name her Nicole. And my mother was like, you cannot name her Nicole. I'm like, why not? She was like, Nicole Cole? Oh. And then I wanted to name her Sabrina. And she was like, you are not naming her after one of the Charlie's Angels. So we ended up with Paula. That's where that was our compromise name. But yes, she lives in Columbus, Ohio, went to the Ohio State. So she is a huge Buckeye fan. Huge.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. She.
Well, shout out to Paula and good luck in her new job. Well, Tasha, it's been great to have you on. Good luck in the coming election. You must be looking forward to having it over and moving on to the next cycle. And thank you to Marcus and Nicole for the introduction. To our audience, remember you can follow us on social media, on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. You can also sign up for our Monday morning email. It comes out, as it's called, every Monday, along with the show. And you can do that at our website at thepoliticallife.net. And so we hope you have a good week. Remember to vote, stay safe, stay healthy, and we will see you next Monday.